Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to Glamorous Trash. Today's episode is a glamorous trash talk episode. It's a book talk episode. Another episode in our series where I talk to an author about their book and ask them five questions I would love to be asked and five questions I would hate to be asked, and we see what happens. And today's guest is super exciting. I've been wanting to meet her for such a long time. She is a Chicago-based millennial multi-hyphenate author, entrepreneur, and pop culture commentator, best known for hosting her weekly pop culture podcast, Be There in Five. Her life changed when she decided to paint "Turn Off Your Curling Iron" on her doormat so she wouldn't burn her apartment down. Her reminder mats captured the zeitgeist, selling thousands, and were featured in Glamour, Good Housekeeping, Real Simple, HuffPost, BuzzFeed, Self, and Martha Stewart. Additionally, her career and commentary have been featured in People, HuffPost, New York Times, BuzzFeed, and The Washington Post. No big deal. Please welcome Kate Kennedy.
Oh my gosh. Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here. I've listened to your show for a long time.
That is so nice. Thank you. I love your show, and I found you on Instagram and sent you one of those messages to, I was just so compelled. And so I'm so happy you're here and I have your book in my hands. That's very exciting.
There's nothing as thrilling as somebody sending you a message who's like in a related creative field. And then you're like, oh my gosh, this was so nice. Cause people don't always reach out just to be like, hey, love what you're doing.
Yeah.
And it means a lot.
It really does. Excited. Yeah. I'm so happy. And I'm happy it brought us together. Okay, tell everyone just like, what's the pitch? What's the log line of the book?
Yeah, so one of the millennial, it's the intersection of two experiences, being a millennial and being a female. And it, with a generational piece, it's really about the pop culture and media and iconography that makes us a product of our time. And with the female piece, it's about how much of my life was marked by the dismissal of my liking those things that make us a product of our time when I was indulging in them in real time. So I'm kind of trying to reclaim all the things that comprised millennial girlhood and argue for their importance. Because as you know, on your show too, great depths can come from the shallowest of places. And we just don't honor the more important things in life enough, I don't think.
I completely agree. And your essay on how Jesse Spano's feminism pushed you off of feminism, it was the exact example of your book doing that. So also for people who, I mean, you can hear it in the book, but one of my favorite chapters was really your work life and like how you left a 9-to-5 and like the hustle culture, and when you're like going back into hustle culture and then starting the podcast, like, I don't know, it just really spoke to not only my life, but all the rom-coms you've seen where it's like, oh my God, she's doing this and then this. And so will you tell people what your starting a podcast story is?
I try to tell the abridged version because it all kind of makes no sense. I had a full-time corporate job in market research. You guys work in media. I worked at Nielsen for many years. And
that is so funny. Yeah. Nielsen boxes are the box like under someone's TV that then sort of dictates all these statistics. And Kate, maybe you want to defend it, but from TV writers, we're always like, one dude in Minneapolis like didn't like the Conners and now it's canceled.
I know. I used to spend my days defending population sampling and explain to people, you know, if you need to get blood work, are they draining your entire body of blood, or are they getting a sample? You know, there's definitely some modernizing that could be done. But I worked in the advertising space of helping people like optimize ad campaigns. But it was in a lot of like audience measurement and consumer behavior type stuff. So I had this like analytic background, understood the media ecosystem, and like peak girl boss, lean in, you know, hustle, grind, you know, love your job and you'll never work another day, you know, like the millennial way. I was inspired to monetize a hobby like many of my peers. And the Friends episode when, you know, Rachel burns down Phoebe's apartment was poignant for me with the curling iron. And I run late, be there in five. And I was like, yeah, I'm going to put this on a doormat and I'm going to sell them. And I sold upside down doormats that said, like, turn off your curling iron on your way out. I did that for several years, scaled up, scaled down. I'm sure you can imagine, you know, flooring wasn't really my legacy. I didn't see that for my life long term. And when you're self-employed, you really have no choice but to follow the money where you can support yourself. And when I became irrelevant to my corporate job and couldn't get hired back, I kind of followed what I knew, hoping I could make money from natural skill where I lacked credentials or any sort of experience. So at the time, I was listening to a lot of podcasts to combat the lonely days of self-employment. And I felt like there weren't a lot of women taking up a ton of space. And it was a lot of quippy short pop culture shows. And I was like, I want to talk for 2 hours about one thing. I want to just, I want to talk about what happened, but also why it matters. And I kind of started this more deep dive format podcast called Be There in Five that's really just designed to keep people company. And one of the hallmarks of that podcast became nostalgia and kind of revisiting a lot of small elements of millennial girlhood. And I'd noticed my most popular episodes weren't like about the viral topics. It was like, let's deep dive how badly we all wanted a vacation boyfriend because we watched too many Mary-Kate and Ashley direct to VHS films. And it was like those pockets of our experience that people would like come to life. And I just was like, wow, this is, it's something special to me that, especially in the experience of womanhood, so you spend so much time trying to shrink yourself and your body and your interests and, you know, adapt them to who you're talking to. And I just felt like there was this whole world out there of people that loved all these shallow things, but were told as young women, they're not things you should like to be taken seriously. And my podcast is really born from those types of topics in a way that it's almost hard to even explain because it kind of covers everything and anything, but it's mostly pop culture.
Obviously, you said it so well, but it's what makes your show so special is that thesis. But also, you have a chapter in this book about like women's interests being deemed like basic to basically take away their power when it is so powerful. Also, I love that you were like, I'm going to take up space in podcasting. I'm going to take up 2 goddamn hours and put a woman's voice out there. Okay. Are you ready for my first question?
I'm so ready, and I love your format. Be there in 5 questions. Like, I wish I had thought of this idea. It's so good.
You can have it. We'll do it together. I'll be the Mary-Kate, you be the Ashley.
I'll have to have you on mine, and I'll do it. I'll flip it on you.
Okay, I love it. Okay, first question, and be honest. Was there a time in life when you read Lean In, and you were like, yes, this is the word?
Oh, yeah. I furiously highlighted Lean In like it was Miranda Priestly in the September issue. Like, when I tell you I girl boss so hard, like, I think that it was when I got into the workplace and found that more of my skills were being rewarded than in school. Like, I'm not that book smart, but I could do other stuff, but it just wasn't valued till I got in the workforce. And I was like, oh, this is great. And I felt empowered. And when Lean In came out, it was kind of, for people like me that were scared to call myself a feminist because of Jesse Spano, when I had my like empowerment moment, I started out from a very like individualistic, capitalistic version of like empowerment.
Yeah, yeah. Like, I deserve a promotion, so yes. I'm a feminist. Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
And you know, that whole book is really not about like what would be liberating, which is being allowed to exist. The book is about like carrying the posture of men in the workforce, like, and blaming us for why we're behind and blaming us for the wage gap. So I think for a couple of years, I really did adopt that where I was like, you know what? The wage gap exists because we're not good enough negotiators. You know, like, I just didn't get it.
Yes.
It was like entry level feminism. It had a place, but I've been trying to lean out ever since.
I'm so embarrassed to remember a moment when I told a friend, you know, like, whatever, 98% of women just don't raise their hand or something. And thankfully she was smarter and more enlightened and was like, we're not doing that. And I was like, oh, so this is, I see. Yeah, it was a hard lesson to learn. Leaned in, fell on my face. Okay, second question. One thing I really love about several episodes I've listened to and also your book is that you can tell that you hold books in high esteem. Obviously, I have a book podcast. I worship them. And there are times when someone writes a book who doesn't hold books in high esteem, and you do. So I want to know, in your opinion, what 3 things does a book need for you to read it and be like, yeah, that's a good book?
I love nonfiction as just a general genre. That's what I gravitate toward. I like stories. I'm interested not in the most extraordinary of people with the most outlandish stories. I'm interested in how ordinary people think and process things. And I feel like so often people think that to be able to sell a book or to be able to write a good book, you have to be like someone exceptional. But I think everybody's exceptional. You're just not looking hard enough. I like essay books. I don't know. I love hearing about people's lives. And the third thing, I think I'm not a technical writer. I'm not a journalist. Like, I'm a creative writer. I play around a lot with sentences and words and structure. And that's not for a lot of people. But I like people that have fun and don't take themselves too seriously in the way that they write. And I just think that when you lean into your voice and like that's the
how dare
it just like really works. And I like getting to know somebody through how they, I don't know, the architecture of the written word. And I think it's very different person to person. And when something's pared down to be like too straightforward or technical, I just am so bored. So like, give me all the bloated metaphors and nonsense that don't drive the plot forward.
What an amazing answer. Also, it was a trick question. And your book did pass all those three things. Nonfiction, essays about not the most extraordinary stories at times, and incredible wordplay. I want to read, I highlighted all over this book. I want to read this sentence that made me scream with laughter. Okay. So you're in a hair cuttery when you say, I'd contemplate an angled cut, a zigzag park, or face framing layers, always opting for just a trim, even though I convinced myself this time would be different and I'd come back to school a new woman. It's interesting to me that for all the time I thought about getting layers, I never felt permission to have them within me. I was like, yes.
I love that you picked that line because I feel like that might have been on the chopping block. And I was like, the girls that get it will get it. Cutting your hair to be a new version of you is one of the tenets of girlhood.
Yeah, absolutely. Also, the layers of, I feel like we're around the same age and it's like, yeah, the remember the layers when you would put your hair in a ponytail and pull it to the top and you just cut, and that was like the layers that the professional gave you. So I was really feeling that. And also talking about like letting yourself have these layers, because another theme in the book that I really loved is how you talk about how you're an observer.
Mm-hmm.
And like you're like on the outside and you observed culture and you observed the cool girls. So my next question for you is, do you think you have actually been able to take away childhood Kate, who was an observer, and fully stand in the part of you now, which is the speaker, the entertainer?
Yeah, I broke the Britney space-time continuum and became an observer that entertains, the third type of people in the world. That's an interesting question. Even at a young age, I like wanted my observations to be heard. And I was a very shy kid that would like stand up at a Borders Books and Music poetry reading and like as a 13-year-old earnestly deliver a poem about inner beauty. And like, I didn't think that was weird. So there's something in me that I think always wanted to entertain. And I think perhaps my obsession with observing popular kids in school and celebrities and so on and so forth is because I had the desire but didn't feel like I had the trappings. And so I would kind of study people for how to get there. And it's kind of, you know, ironic that the further I accepted kind of my nature, that's when like things came together for me.
It's,
you know, just being wordy and detailed and observational, like that ended up being kind of the hallmark of my career and not trying to do what other people were doing.
Yeah, I love that answer. Okay, you talked about how that line was on the chopping block. What was the worst note you were given in the book process?
Oh my gosh, the legal read was so funny because one of my favorite things to do is give like a pop culture reference in passing. If you miss it, you miss it. If you get it, you get it. And like, who cares?
Yeah.
Just think I love specific stuff. But when a 55-year-old, you know, man named Carl is reviewing your book for a legal read, they're like, okay, I just, you know, want to make sure. Do you know Nicholas Parker or Elizabeth James in real life? You said some very disparaging things about them and their parenting. And I was like, oh, no. Carl, those are the parents from The Parent Trap. Like, so just like things like that would crack me up because I'll be trying to make a joke. And if you catch the joke, you'll get it. But if you don't, you'll think it's a typo or I'm speaking wrong. Like a small thing was like in the chapter, are we going out or out, out? I said, like, for every Luke that wouldn't warm up to me, I had 8 sorority sisters tell me that I was so hot. And the joke is like lukewarm and hot. But yeah. I would notice like edits be made to that completely
butchered it.
It wasn't, the joke wasn't there anymore. So I kind of had to go through, because you know at a point you get to edits, you're just like, accept. I think that I probably accepted a lot of things that maybe like were at the expense of wordplay. But honestly, if it wasn't that clear anyway, then that's the right thing to do.
Good for you. I totally had one of those rounds because I have a book coming out too. And I had a round where I just like click. In some chapter, I must have blacked out and I clicked accept. And then when I went to do the reread, I was like, what the fuck is this? And it was just like 4, you know, precise word choices that made me technically a better writer and like totally destroyed any semblance of a joke. So I'm very with you. Okay, this feels like a good time to take a quick break. Bad on Paper is a podcast that I think the cookies might love. It is a chat show hosted by Becca Freeman and Olivia Mentor, and new episodes drop every Wednesday. Both hosts are huge readers. It's a lot about books, and they talk about what they're reading every episode. Like us, their show hosts a monthly book club. The book club pick is announced at the beginning of the month and discussed in the last episode of the month. Recent picks have included Happy Place by Emily Henry, Fourth Wing by Rebecca Yarros, and Family Lore by Elizabeth Acevedo. Listeners say the show feels like having a glass of wine with your best friends. Topics range from everything from your favorite rom-com tropes to which hyped-up products are worth it to how to get over your imposter syndrome. Occasionally, they are also joined by guests, often fellow authors, like Nora McInerney, Emma Straub, Jennifer Weiner, and more. Both hosts are currently writing books, so it's really interesting to follow their updates on the process of writing and publishing, if that's something you're interested in, and I know many cookies are. Even though there's a big back catalog, you can truly jump in anywhere. Bad on Paper episodes really require no context, and you'll get to know the hosts as you listen. Sibling fights are unavoidable, but what if every fight you had was under a microscope on a global scale? That's the reality for brothers Prince William and Prince Harry. They were each other's closest friends and allies since the death of their mother. But that all began to crack as they married and took wildly different approaches to their royal duties. Wondery's podcast, Dis and Tell, is hosted by comedians Sydney Battle and Matt Bellassai. Each episode unpacks one of pop culture's most iconic celebrity feuds, and they recently took a deeper look into the real reason William versus Harry started. It's actually much bigger than these two brothers, stretching back into the history of the British monarchy. Did their feud start with the royal family's mistreatment of Meghan Markle, or was it something that started much earlier? Follow Dis and Tell on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. I started this podcast because I have been obsessed with memoirs my entire life. And I can't believe it, but I got to write my own. And it comes out on June 4th, and you can order it right now. The book, you know, I was asked to describe it and I said, it is an absolutely harrowing, traumatic memoir, but funny. So if that sounds good to you, order it. Let me give you some topics that are in this memoir. We talk about how I got into Hollywood, all those nitty gritty details that people usually skip. I put all those in there because, you know, I'm not skipping that stuff. How I got to be Jon Stewart's head writer. I got some celebrity stories. I talk some trash for sure. And I talk about really the most haunting, harrowing things that have ever happened to me. And really, everything I look for when I read a memoir, I put into my own. I gave this book everything I had. Each chapter title is a different woman's name in my life. Some are heroes, some are motherfucking villains. But you know what? A villain and a hero, what are both of those things? A leading role. And we do love women in our leading roles. So pre-order the book. It matters a lot. I linked everywhere that you can buy it in the show notes, but, you know, go anywhere. Also, I am reading the audiobook personally, so I'm personally narrating it. So if you like this podcast, get my longest podcast ever. And the audiobook is also available for pre-sale everywhere you get audiobooks. And thank you so much for listening to this podcast. You are the reason I got to write a memoir. So thank you so, so much. Okay, let's dive back into the episode. Okay, since you cover the millennial zeitgeist and early aughts so well, fuck, marry, kill. Brittany, Christina, Jessica.
I would marry Jessica because I just loved newlyweds, and it would basically be like living in that. I'd probably kill Christina because the too dirty to clean my act up era. It's like, you could argue you'd want to fuck that, but then I would never kill Brittany. I would never. So yeah, kill Christina, fuck Brittany. Christina, like, has such an interesting career when you think about it. Yeah. We never talk about her song with Ricky Martin, Nobody Wants to Be Lonely. Do you remember that?
I had completely wiped that from my memory, so thank you. That's incredible. Also, can I tell you, I want Christina's memoir so bad. And not just because we have Jessica and Bernice, but like, she has a really wild backstory. She has a single mom, and her dad was really violent. And like, I think there's like some insane story to them escaping her dad. And like, I need that story, you know. And then what, wow, 5 years later, she's going to start making like demos. So wow, that's a life. That's a life.
You know, I don't know much about her background at all. Now that you're saying that, she's really not done a lot of like opening up over the years.
And I think that's why.
Probably, you know, that's why.
I need Xtina with a big X on the cover of her memoir, like letting it all out. I think she's getting close with Jessica and Brittany. Don't you feel like she must be feeling the push?
She has to be getting close. And I'd read an entire book on the making the video of Lady Marmalade. Like,
yes.
Like, she was part of so many big cultural moments. I'd love to hear about it. And I mean, her music video for Beautiful, that was like groundbreaking at the time.
Yeah, it really was. It was like a Lady Gaga before, you know, when she did all her like Beautiful acceptance music videos before Gaga. You heard it here first. Okay. Have you ever gone on Goodreads and read your reviews?
Absolutely not. So what I do is I have I call her my friendager, Courtney. She sends me the good ones that she thinks I'll be interested in, because I do value people's feedback. But the thing people have to understand about this type of work is that, you know, you get job feedback on your job performance. It's not personal. You just execute differently and move forward. Feedback on this sort of book is so profoundly personal that it buries itself in my head in an unhealthy way. So yeah, when there is feedback that is genuinely productive, I'm told it. But otherwise, I'm not masochistic enough. I think earlier in my career I would have been, but now I know better from years of being an internet person that the more negative things you hear about yourself, the more you start to self-edit when you create. And then you're really not creating from an organic place. You're creating from a place of your own perceived likability, which I think is a trap. And so I love and respect all the good readers and your reviews. But I was interviewing Emily Henry, you know, like Happy Place and Beach Read.
Oh, yeah. Love her.
And that was her biggest piece of advice to me. And she's huge. She is like, she's optioned like all her books for movies. Like, she could not be bigger and she could not have better reviews. And she was just like, don't do it. Because even people that give you 5-star reviews are going to be like, yeah, I thought she was a huge bitch and I hated all of her other books, but this one was great. And it's like, you'll even get offended if you filter by 5 stars. And I think you have to know thyself. And I think some people have thin skin, and my skin really does not get thicker as I age. I'm just able to tease out which opinions I do and don't respect, I guess.
That was so well said. And also, I just want to just 5 gold stars to being so emotionally healthy that you're like, I know this and I'm not going to do it, you know? And it's not like, well, at 2 a.m., if, you know, if no one's around, I will log in.
I'm sure you've too, like, you've had that experience where you read the wrong thing at the wrong time and it ruins something going on in your actual life. It kills the vibe. It ruins a major event. Somebody said something so heinous to me when I was like lying in bed after being rehospitalized postpartum. And I was like, you know, sitting there getting like an EKG and I'm like just stewing over this troll. And I'm like, this is nuts. Like, yeah. I have to draw boundaries.
That's incredible. Okay. A big question about the book. I feel from you that you've like had a book in you. Has it always been this one, or were you like coming to the idea of pitching this specific type of book slowly?
No, really, I wanted to write a long form book, a nonfiction book, something more essay style. And the kind of partial pitch I had was, you know, great depths coming from shallow interests and kind of life lessons learned.
Yeah.
And in the least likely of places, because part of the book is like, my life, when I look back on my life, I don't think about milestones. I say that the day I bought a Vera Bradley bag, I remember it better than my high school graduation. Like, there's something weird about the like brands and products and social functions we participated in that like are just so much more memorable and important than any of the stuff I thought would be important was. Really what happened is I have been trying to sell like this loose concept forever, but most people were like, eh, I think the book that you could sell is like the Be There in Five story, like kind of more of a career book. And like, mm-hmm. I'll be damned if I write a career. I have no business. I can't help myself. I'm not going to write self-help.
You're like the girl boss stops here. No.
Yeah. It just, I knew even if I was offered a ton of money, like that is not the book I could ever write. And that was kind of all what I was hearing that people were interested in. And then I was doing live podcast shows in 2021. And I had some different essays I had written. One was Limited Two, one was Pumpkin Spice Girl. And I was doing a show at Chelsea Music Hall and I was backstage and I got on my computer right before I went out, pulled some paragraphs from these essays. And I was like, I'm just going to read them on stage because I'm not a comedian. I can't workshop material. I have no proof that people care. So I read two paragraphs from these essays that were going nowhere. And it just so happened there was a person from Macmillan in the audience and they got me a meeting and I got a really strong book deal that I didn't even shop around from them.
Kate, that is the most magical, beautiful story. It's like, it's half just like cosmic fate destiny and it's half like, yeah, read your shit, put yourself out there.
That's the lesson. And that's kind of what I was trying to convey in that chapter, Be There in Five. It's like the only thing that separates me from anybody else is I've just tried a bunch of stuff. And
yeah.
And I think that, you kind of do have to be a bit shameless in getting your own work out there. And I knew that I was never going to get anything through like major industry gatekeepers. Everything that's ever happened has been because a podcast listener did it for me, honest to God. And that's the other magical part of this and a really cool thing millennials have done with the internet. It's democratized talent. It's, you know, really transcended gatekeepers where for better or for worse, you can find your audience without a lot of barriers that used to exist. And it's very cool that outside of having, you know, a agent and a proposal and like having to go all through all these hoops like I did with my first book, the biggest difference with this one is like I found people who got it. And through my body of work that existed, they already understood me, so I didn't have to over explain. And they just trusted that I would figure out the book because it didn't have a title until very far in the process even. So
oh wow, incredible, because yeah, you're so good with language and it's such a perfect title. Did you have a nightmare title process or was it like you woke up one day and you're like one in a millennial?
I had another title. What was it? Oh, I think it was something about like millennial or millennialden days or something, and like they didn't want people to feel old, and I was like, yeah, I agree. And then I think I just wrote down a bunch of like puns with million because that was the closest thing to millennial. And they told me which one like stood out to them. And then all of a sudden it really made sense because one of the things that was killing me writing this book was the fear that people would think that I thought I represented everybody. And I was like, this is perfect. It is just one millennial story. And millennials are kind of stereotyped to think we're special. And it's like kind of tongue in cheek in that way too. Like I'm telling the most asinine of tales of a very normal existence in a suburb and acting like it's one in a million.
That's so, yeah, it's a fantastic title. It is one of my favorite book covers. When your cover dropped, I sent it to my editor and I was like, this is a great book cover.
Oh my
like,
gosh.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Your fear reminds me of this thing I think about all the time of how Lena Dunham in The Pilot of Girls, her character jokingly says, I am the voice of my generation because she's like unemployed and like, you know, is stealing $20 from her parents. And the media took it and was like, Lena Dunham says she's the voice of a generation. And it was like this massive weight upon her from the start. And I'm going to say makes me laugh, but it like makes me sad that it was like a joke in her pilot that like went way too far and kind of like crushed her maybe before she like got a chance, you know?
Oh, totally. I think about moments like that all the time where people just something doesn't land quite the right way and it's assigned to them for eternity. And
yeah,
I think that's any creative sphere is just like being defined by like one thing that doesn't quite work.
Oh my God, completely. Okay, so you just said on the podcast, but you also wrote about how the internet has democratized art, which I also loved. And the big thing it does too is it now we have like more women creators, more diversity, more everything of all these ways where it's like, oh, there is an audience for this because here I've shown you. However, on the flip side, you will also have someone who's like, I do TikToks of makeup and now they have a book deal. Mm-hmm. Or like I do stand up to my mirror and now I have the HBO special. I never had to go on stage. This is where I'm like, oh my God, I'm old. Because I have this thing where I'm like, yes, democratize art. And then I'm like, but wait, you have to sweat and prove it and like earn the thing. And so that's my question for you. Like, how do we feel about this sphere opening up?
The mature side of me wants to give you there's space for everyone, you know, type response.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because I believe that, and I do.
Yeah.
I don't think there's finite.
All boats rise.
Yes, right. But I felt with podcasting, I think that it's a job that's misunderstood, and it's a bit of a grind, and it's incredibly hard to grow. And there was a time when there weren't that many people in the game, and then you kind of feel like your job was dismissed by broader entertainment, but then everyone in entertainment gets a podcast all of a sudden, and then they take up all the share and like kind of push you out.
Which is a very real thing, right? Like this ad year is like, oh, this A-list celebrity talks to his friends. They do all the MeUndies, no more ads for other podcasters.
The ad landscape is changing in ways that I fear independent, podcasters. Yeah. It's hard to stay afloat. It's something that like, honest to God, has been really hard, not from a place of my own jealousy as much as it becomes really difficult to compete with virality, with reach that is ungodly relative to what you could build in like a slow, nominal, consistent way. And I think that the thing that upsets me more so than somebody else getting something is when podcasts or books or whatever, they feel like merch. Your job feels like, well, that's another revenue stream. Someone write my book and I'll collect on it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it does. It bothers me, but there's also nothing I can do about it. So I don't put a ton of thought into it. I also realize that like I'll probably have longevity in it, whereas for this person, it's more of a one-off. And I think what we've seen over time, especially with celebrity podcasts, is if you're not into it, you can't sustain it. And it's not going to be a core part of your brand, and you're not going to be able to maintain listeners. And I think having a lack of interest in doing it or phoning it in becomes transparent. So I kind of just try to like wait it out and see like, what's the longevity here? Because like, once you go from the goes viral to Dancing with the Stars pipeline, like I'm not really sure where else you go.
Listen, on this podcast, when you have reached Dancing with the Stars, we're in hell. You know, like this is when the apocalypse begins. Once you're on Dancing with the Stars, and you're ending your book about your life story, about how you dance the cha-cha at merengue. Like, it's over for all of us.
I mean, now it's the Dancing with the Stars to Roxy and Chicago Pipeline, or reality TV to Roxy with Erica Jane.
Can I tell you, I have screamed about that on this podcast before, where it's like, it is the one Broadway role where you just kind of talk. There's no singing involved. So Pamela Anderson's like, that's why they all play Roxy, because you don't have to sing.
Okay, that's what's always confused me. I'm like, dang, I can't believe all of these people have the pipes.
No, they never play Velma because she has real songs. Roxy does, I just have a voice and da, 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 da. You don't even have to really dance. Yeah.
Wow. Okay, that makes a lot more sense, because I was here thinking that, like, that's an example of, like, if I mean, talk about a grind. Getting into Broadway, then to be paid the least to do the most, to be the most insanely talented people in the world, and then have celebrities pop in and out, I'd be like, are you serious?
I mean, that's exactly what I was, it was funny. I was totally on the Lea Michele side of Funny Girl only because she's like a tried and true like theater kid. And when Beanie Feldstein
she'll
was
bring
just
money
like,
to Broadway. She'll bring attention in ways it deserves to raise all ships.
But I mean, like, at least she suffered for the role, where like Beanie Feldstein was like, yeah, I'll try and sing. Sure. And you're like,
bless
wait a minute.
Heart.
And then just think of, all I could think of was just all the actresses who were like, really? Like, why did I, you know, go to vocal lessons every day?
the Leah, I forgot about the Leah Michele era of TikTok. I mean, that really revived her persona in a big way, where prior to that, if you looked up Leah Michele on TikTok, it was all those weird rumors about her not being able to read.
Yeah, you're right. Oh my God, she should see this as a positive thing. The drama with Funny
it
Girl.
Really worked out in her favor.
It really did. Okay, this is my last question for you. What do you hope that someone who reads your book like says to their friend about it?
Oh, that's a really nice question. As simple and common and colloquial as it is, it means a lot to me when people say they feel seen. And I think that that's kind of the ultimate goal. Toward the end of the book, I kind of draw the conclusion that I didn't realize I kind of was writing this quest for identity when I felt very lost and buried in my own life, trying to like become a mom and doing IVF and feeling scared of the overturning of Roe v. Wade and like all these things. And it was very much like my life had become like about who I was going to be to somebody else, about having a kid or being a wife. And I realized like my whole life, you just kind of are positioned, you know, or at least me growing up in the South, I thought of my life up until I was like 35, 40. But then after that, it was just like blank. And it was kind of my manifesto of like, regardless of what happens from here or who I become to somebody else, what I've already done, who I already am, is enough. And to honor and celebrate all of the things I loved and the times when I felt like I couldn't be loud and proud about it is really meaningful to me. And I just stir people to really prioritize their own pleasure and see their leisure, forms of leisure, as valid. And I think women go through so much, especially around my age, that for the love of God, if we can't just like enjoy our reality TV, enjoy our guilty pleasures, or however you want to label them, like, what the hell are we doing? Like, I just want people to like what they like and not worry so much about being liked.
That was so beautiful. Thank you so much for coming on. There are so many places to buy a book, but where is your favorite place for people to buy yours?
Oh, I mean, I always just say wherever books are sold.
There's a
really great bookshop that's woman-owned near in Chicago, called Roscoe Books, that I love. I just always have the Macmillan link on my Instagram that has all of the links, and bookshops a great way to support indies, and yeah, wherever you want. And fun fact, I narrated the audiobook 9 months pregnant, so that was a journey. And I'm really proud of that too.
That is so wild. Yeah, that's intense. Also, as a podcaster, I can't imagine how good the audiobook is. I mean, I read it, but maybe I have to listen. Thank you so much for coming on. Just everything once again. So it's One in a Millennial by Kate Kennedy. We'll put all the links in the show notes. And what is your handle? Is it just
it's at Kate Kennedy. Is me. My podcast is at Be There in Five, FIVE. And yeah, One in a Millennial out January 23rd.
That's all for this week's episode. If you have something to say, you want to talk back to this episode, or you have a question, or maybe you think you have a difference of opinion, join the book club. The book club is on Patreon. We have a chat, and there are so many cookies in the chat. We talk about the episodes. We talk about book recommendations. We just talk about our lives. We break things down. It's super fun. It's on Patreon. You can join for as little as $1 or $5 a month, and then just download the mobile app, and you can chat all day long with us. Also, if you join Patreon, all the episodes are ad-free. So we started running ads. If you don't like that, join our Patreon. We send you a podcast feed with ad-free episodes, and everyone comes to your phone. You would also get all of the bonus episodes, and there are so many great bonus episodes. You get all of that when you join our Patreon. And if you're a super hardcore cookie, we have a live book club on Zoom once a month. It's on Sundays. It's so fun. Sometimes we dress up, we chat about the episodes. No reading is required. If you want to read along, it's so fun, but also most people just listen to the episode and then we chat and hang out and check in, and a lot of really deep friendships have formed. It's the best. A big thank you to our podcast producer, Kate Downey, our executive producer, Jordan Moncada, our sound engineer, Marcus Hom, and our amazing assistant, Jaren Padre. I also want to thank our friends over at Pattern Brands. They are our product partner, and they keep me and my guests just rolling in the cutest tiny spoons and candles and so many other cool things. And Paquetto, I genuinely love our product partners. I love them so much. So go check them out. Everything is linked in the show notes. And if you have questions, go to the Patreon chat lounge, and I'll see you there.